WMAL News at 7. Good morning. I'm Heather Curtis. At least 7 people are dead after a massive tornado ripped through several counties in Mississippi last night, leaving behind a trail of destruction.
At one point, radar estimated wind speeds topped 150 miles per hour. Multiple people were taken to area hospitals after being pulled from the debris. Those severe storms are still roaring across the South, but are expected to weaken on Saturday. The National Weather Service says it will begin surveying the damage this weekend to determine the tornado's strength. Mike Rollins, Fox Weather.
Days after a Quince Orchard High School student had an apparent overdose in the bathroom of a nearby McDonald's at lunchtime, Montgomery County Schools will hold another family forum on fentanyl today. Health officer Dr. Keisha Davis.
We do want to commend the students who helped the student, the Quince Orchard High School student. From what we hear, they did what they're supposed to do. They called 911, they alerted the authorities, they gave Narcan, and that is the message that we want.
The forum today goes from 9 to noon at Paint Branch High School. Meanwhile, Quince Orchard started cracking down yesterday, enforcing a policy that only allows juniors and seniors to leave campus for lunch. If you live in Stafford County, your property taxes may be going up by more than $1,000 next year. The Board of Supervisors approved setting the advertised tax rate at $1.17 per $100 of assessed value, up from 85 cents. Supervisor Meg Bumke voted no.
This would be the largest tax rate increase in Stafford County history.
It would help pay for a proposed 12% increase in the county budget. Tanisha Allen.
We've severely understaffed our county government for, the last 10 years.
The advertised rate is the maximum limit of what they can set when they vote next month. Tonight is National Lights Out.
It's an international effort to raise awareness about light pollution and protect the night sky.
We're asking to just flick off your lights at 8:30 Saturday night.
For 1 hour, says Jim Doherty with the D.C. chapter of the International Dark Sky Association.
I live in downtown Washington. On a good night, I can probably see no more than 30 stars. And a whole generation of youth is growing up unaware of the majesty of the constellations and the starry sky. And so we've definitely lost something in recent decades.
Barbara Britt, WMAL and WMAL.com.
And if you do turn your lights out, you'll see more than just stars.
Lots of people around the world will get a chance to see 5 planets parade together across the night sky over the next several days. And you won't even need a telescope, although binoculars will help. Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, and Uranus are gathered on the same side of the sun and can be seen beside the crescent moon. Carmen Roberts, Fox News.
WMAL Sports in the NCAA Men's Tournament. Miami beat Houston. San Diego State took down Alabama. That means there will be no number one seeds in the Elite Eight for the first time since seeding began. Up next, traffic and weather. Traffic and weather on News Talk 105.9 WMAL. Here's Mike Franciotti in the Hadid Carpet Cleaning Traffic Center.
In Virginia, still have the accident interloop at Van Dorn Street. 2 lanes remain blocked at that location. Once beyond that point, making your way over toward the Springfield interchange, no reports of any issues at this time. Beltway traffic looks good in Virginia. Interstate 66, 395, and Interstate 95 moving well. Going into Maryland, still have the issue in Montgomery County. Route 29, Columbia Pike, still shut down northbound at Lockwood Drive. Southbound, you still lose the left lane. Now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Storm Watch 7 forecast.
Showers through lunchtime, but after that, rain goes away. Clouds will be on the decrease, and a little bit of sunshine to end your Saturday. Temperatures into the low 60s. Tonight we fall down to 49. Tomorrow it's 68 for a high temperature and plenty of sunshine. I'm 7 News meteorologist Jordan Evans in the First Alert Weather Center.
Right now, 44 degrees in Washington. I'm Heather Curtis on News Talk 105.9 WMAL.
Now, on News Talk 105.9 WMAL.
The Saturday Morning Update.
Hour 2 of the Saturday Morning Update. That means John Gizzi joins us, White House correspondent, chief political columnist at Newsmax.com. John, good morning.
Good morning, Rick.
Attacks this week on U.S. installations in Syria attributed to Iran, and this comes on the heels of the meeting between Xi Jinping and Vladimir Putin, and that, of course, after Iran negotiated with China on an agreement with Saudi Arabia. So how does all of this interconnect?
Well, National Security Council spokesman John Kirby said that the summit between Xi and Putin cannot be anything peaceful or productive. He held it all in minimum high regard at the White House briefing this week. Look, every time one sees Putin and Xi together, it's no stretch of the imagination to conclude that when the Iranian Revolutionary Guard is doing something nefarious, not far behind them are the People's Army of China and the Red Army, Vladimir Putin's stormtroopers. Throw in North Korea again, and voila. As more than one politician in each major party has said, we have a new axis of evil. Now, do we have any hard evidence that the Chinese and the Russians were behind this? No, but Iran continues to ship arms and parts for arms to China at this point. I might add that the shipments have grown under the watch of Joe Biden, and the sanctions that were put in after the end of the Iran nuclear agreement have been slowly lifted. This is a hot spot we're talking about, and it's grown hotter than usual.
Bibi Netanyahu, of course, back as the Prime Minister of Israel. He is scoring victories on his domestic agenda. But as we heard the other day from General Mark Milley, Iran is very close in developing a nuclear weapon. What would that mean in terms of Israel? If we don't take the action that Bibi Netanyahu would want to see, what happens?
Well, what would happen would be that Iran would, in all likelihood, launch a strike against what the Ayatollah calls the little Satan, as opposed to the big Satan, the United States. And domestic politics in Israel have a lot to do with this. In passing his reform of the court system in Israel, allowing a greater hand by the government and the parliament, known as the Knesset, Bibi Netanyahu has sparked major strikes and demonstrations throughout the country. Police were using water cannons in just about every major city, as by a simple majority vote, 61-59, the Knesset passed Mr. Netanyahu's long-wanted reforms. Reforms, I might add, that protect him from indictment and resulting removal from office. Now, among the major protesters are the army reservists, and Israel is a country in which a majority of its men and women in uniform are in the reserves. They're weekend warriors, but they take time out from their jobs and their lives every time Israel is threatened. Many are refusing to report to their weekend training as a result of the reform of the court. If you think the two are unrelated, think of Israel without its fighting force, its dashing air force, and its infantry troops on the ground who have turned back invaders for more than half a century. And then just look at what Iran is doing. The timing couldn't be worse for Israel.
Major event on Capitol Hill this week, the TikTok hearings. And where do you see this going in terms of maybe some bipartisan action in both the House and the Senate?
Key word, Rick, is bipartisan. On Monday, before the hearings even began, I attended a press breakfast hosted by the Christian Science Monitor featuring Senate Intelligence Committee Chairman Mark Warner, Democrat of Virginia. He went into the hearings concluding one thing: TikTok is not an American corporation, it's a Chinese corporation. But it's unusual in the sense TikTok gives its loyalty not to its CEO, not to the shareholders, but to the Communist Party of China. Therefore, he was going into the hearings with a very slanted and hostile view towards TikTok, and not adverse to stripping them of what they had that made them an American corporation. In any event, the hearings began on the House side. Chairman Kathy McMorris Rodgers of Washington State said flatly she did not believe the claims of TikTok CEO Sochu that they were not engaged in propaganda. And again, it was what Senator Warner said, the specter of the Communist Party that gripped Republican and Democratic members of the Energy Committee. In the end, it didn't look good for TikTok, and it doesn't look good for the continuance of its services to 150 million American subscribers. We'll see.
I want to turn to a story that broke yesterday, the Rwandan government announcing that Paul Rusesabagina, who inspired the 2004 film Hotel Rwanda, will be released from prison nearly 3 years after he was captured and detained. You know him personally. You know his family personally. You have interviewed them in the past. To begin with, John, give us a little background on the arrest and why he was detained.
In August of 2020, Paul Rusesabagina made headlines worldwide. The hero of the film Hotel Rwanda, portrayed by Don Cheadle, was arrested as he was changing planes in Africa on his way to a speaking date, the invitation issued by a Catholic bishop. Rwanda brought him back to its capital, Kigali, and charged him with murder and treason. Now, it should be pointed out, although he is, of course, a Rwandan, Mr. Rusesabagina and his family live in Texas and they're citizens of Belgium. This provoked some outrage from the Trump administration and the State Department and later from the Biden administration, a violation of sovereign law, or so several spokesmen have said. In any event, he went on trial. After a while, he finally got his own counsel, and he was found guilty of murder and treason and sentenced to 30 years in prison. I spent a lot of time with his daughter, Anais, her mother, and sister, and they swear it is absolutely untrue. Members of Congress agreed. A bipartisan resolution came out, offered by Congressman Castro, Democrat of Texas, and Republican Young Kim of California, calling for his release. In any event, the government, which had sentenced him to 30 years in prison on these charges, finally relented yesterday and said it was commuting his sentence along with those of other prisoners. But a statement from the Rwandan embassy here said they still believe he is guilty, and if he engages in any other acts, he will be charged again. For my part, I know that this is a subject that will be debated and that there'll be a lot of questions for the hero of Hotel Rwanda when he returns to this country. I hope to get him on Newsmax and get his side of the story.
John Gizzi, the White House correspondent, chief political columnist at Newsmax.com. John, as always, thank you very much. It's 7:18 Saturday morning update. Mike Franciati's in the WMAL Traffic Center.
Montgomery County, the Interloop Georgia Avenue. We've got the accident there. Both right off ramps and the right shoulder are closed and traffic a little bit hung up on the Interloop as you make your way toward Georgia Avenue. No issues on the I-270 corridor at this time. Also in Montgomery County, still have the accident, the road closure along Columbia Pike, U.S. Route 29, northbound, still shut down at Lockwood Drive. In the Virginia Interloop at Van Doren, still have the accident there, blocking two lanes. Now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Storm Watch 7 forecast.
Showers stick around through lunchtime, but after that, rain goes away, clouds will be on the decrease, and a little bit of sunshine to end your Saturday. Temperatures into the low 60s right around 6 p.m. Tonight we fall down to 49. Tomorrow it's 68 for a high temperature. Northwest winds around 15 to 20 miles per hour and plenty of sunshine. I'm 7 News meteorologist Jordan Evans in the First Alert Weather Center.
43 degrees in the nation's capital, 7:19 on the Saturday morning update.
News Talk 105.9 WMAL.
Making sense of the news.
The Saturday Morning Update continues. I'm Rick Fowler. Cheryl Atkinson is with us each week. Emmy Award-winning journalist, host of Full Measure. That's tomorrow morning, ABC 7, 10 o'clock. Good morning, Cheryl.
Good morning.
We hear a lot about the gun control debate, different gun legislation in different areas of the country. Something different going on in San Jose, California, and a lot of jurisdictions are watching this. Tell us what they're doing and what that impact may be.
Well, I think this is an outgrowth of last summer's Supreme Court decision, which tossed out a big New York gun control law and any law that was like it across the country. And as a result, cities and states are trying to figure out new ways to enact gun control that is impervious to court challenge. So that led me to San Jose, California, where they recently enacted a first-of-its-kind local law that requires people carry gun liability insurance, number one. Number two, it requires them to pay a $25 a year fee on their weapons and then carry proof, the papers that they've done all of this, with the weapons at all times. And the fee, by the way, doesn't go to the government. It goes to a nonprofit to supposedly prevent gun violence or acts committed with guns that kill people. So this is controversial for many reasons. Someone was saying that, gosh, there's a constitutional right of free association that's violated by forcing your money to go to a nonprofit you may not agree with. There are questions about forcing the liability insurance thing. So if it does hold, there are court challenges already, you're going to see other cities and states do similar things. And they've been consulting with San Jose already to try to watch this law.
When you say gun liability insurance, that would strike me that an insurance company may kind of have a heyday with rates because they're going to say, wait a minute, you're carrying a weapon that's lethal, and I'm going to insure you. I can charge you anything I want.
Well, yeah, when the government says you have to have it and the insurance company knows that, can they put whatever terms they want on it? And one of the people who thought up this idea, which is now the ex-mayor of San Jose, who was term limited out, Sam Licardio, he says that part of the incentive was let the insurance companies dictate the rules to people that they insure. You have to have, you know, the insurance company may say you have to keep your gun in a lockbox, may say all kinds of things that the government wants but can't force itself. The insurance company, you know, they say private industry could do that. It's a cost. Nobody I spoke to in San Jose had the liability insurance yet, even though it's a requirement. They didn't know about it. We went to a gun range. Most people didn't even know about the law, surprisingly. So we'll have to see what those prices are and if this holds up in court, how that works out for people to be forced to carry this insurance.
We've seen in the news, in the wake of COVID-19, sort of the lack of enthusiasm of people wanting to go back to work. And when you have the issues in the workplace where you don't have enough people applying for work, employers starting to drop maybe their standards of employment. What are you finding on that?
Well, that's an interesting way to put it, because they are dropping, in some cases, the formal educational requirements. But a lot of people are arguing the standards are actually being raised. So let me put it this way. Without enough workers applying for a job, maybe a government job that required a college degree now says no college degree required, and instead they're hiring people who have real-world experience or something else that they're finding out is sometimes a lot better than the college degree. Because as we know, not only is college too expensive for many people, it's also not always preparing the students for what we call real-world skills as much as we hope that it would. So this could be a win-win for the companies and the people that didn't get to college.
I think often the sense of experience and street smarts may well outweigh a college degree where you're somewhere for 4 years and you get out and you really haven't experienced the world. So interesting.
I think there's a lot of people that agree with that, and they're finding that out.
The Fast and Furious scandal in the Obama administration is a story you've been covering for years. In fact, Cheryl Atkinson won an Emmy Award for her reporting on the Fast and Furious back in 2012. And there is more information that will come out soon. You have a fascinating interview tomorrow.
Well, let me remind people, Fast and Furious isn't just the name of the movie series. It was also the code name of one of many operations the government was secretly running that it denied for quite a while that it was running, that allowed weapons from the United States to be sold and put in the hands of Mexican drug cartels. And I broke that story at CBS and covered it for a couple of years all the way through to the government finally admitting, yes, it did do that despite its denials. And I think maybe people may remember the one and only time of the Obama presidency, he invoked an executive privilege to withhold documents was to keep these final White House Fast and Furious related documents secret. So to this day, we don't have all the answers about how that operation was done and who knew what and what all they did. Well, fast forward now, and I met a French documentarian who's making an international documentary that goes through Fast and Furious but beyond. His name's Romain Bollinger. He's a journalist. And he's actually been down to Mexico and taken the story really where I couldn't take it back in the day because it required would have required me taking off work for months and investigating things in Mexico, which I just didn't have the luxury of doing at CBS News. He did the work, and he raises the question as to what role the U.S. has had in the rise of Mexico's drug cartels. And he finds a lot of information and sourcing for some information I did report on at the time that had to do with the U.S. allowing the Sinaloa cartel in Mexico to operate here. They actually had a formal written agreement, according to court documents, the U.S., to allow the cartel to sell drugs and operate in the U.S. in exchange for giving information on other cartels. And it sounds unbelievable, but I actually saw the documents. The testimony is there in black and white. I did report on this for CBS News. But this documentary has even more information about the U.S. role in the rise of Mexico's drug kingpins and how the DEA, our law enforcement agency, has been working with, along with the Mexican government, working with some of the cartel figures who they helped make big in order to tamp down other cartel figures. Really interesting story. It'll be a great documentary.
Cheryl Atkinson, host of Full Measure. Catch it tomorrow morning, ABC 7 at 10 o'clock. And also would send you to CherylAtkinson.com. Stories there that you will not see covered in the mainstream media, and they are factual at CherylAtkinson.com. Cheryl, thank you so much as always.
Thank you. Have a great weekend.
You too. 727, Saturday morning update on WMAL. 730 News coming up with Heather Curtis. Then we are back with Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer and K.T. McFarland. Stick around with us.
WMAL-FM, Woodbridge, Washington, a Cumulus Media station.
Making sense of the news.
News Talk 105.9.
WMAL. News now.
WMAL News at 7:30. Good morning, I'm Heather Curtis. Utter destruction in the Mississippi Delta region after a powerful tornado rips through last night, killing at least seven people and injuring many more. It stayed on the ground for at least 90 miles, sending debris more than 20,000 feet into the atmosphere, according to Fox Weather meteorologist Ian Oliver. Storm tracker Zachary Hall tells Fox News he watched it slam into the town of Rolling Fork.
It had a loud roar, train-like noise. Very spooky, you know, and it's dark, so you're only able to see the tornado with lightning flashes. And we unfortunately watched this tornado track into town before we had to turn back around. And then the rain obscured our view. But, yeah, it was a scary situation.
And in Pennsylvania, two people are dead, others injured, some unaccounted for, after a historic factory that makes chocolates exploded. The blast was at buildings used by the R.M. Palmer Company.
They're still trying to figure out what exactly caused this explosion. And the mayor saying that she's a firefighter herself and saying that she was one of the first people on scene and she'd never seen anything like it.
Eddie Kadam of Fox TV affiliate WTXF. D.C. police say a gun was found inside the car of a man shot to death by a park police officer a week ago today. Park police said two of their officers helped a D.C. cop try to detain 17-year-old Delanio Martin, who they say stole a vehicle in Northeast. As they were trying to do that, they say Martin sped off with one officer inside the vehicle, another being dragged behind it. They say the officer inside the vehicle shot Martin, killing him before the vehicle crashed into a home. WMAL Sports in the NCAA tournament, there will be no number one seeds in the Elite Eight for the first time since seeding began. Up next, traffic and weather. Traffic and weather on News Talk 105.9 WMAL. Here's Mike Franciotti in the Hadid Carpet Cleaning Traffic Center.
We've got two separate issues along the inner loop of the Beltway in Virginia at Van Dorn. Still have this now long-standing crash. Two lanes are blocked, two right lanes, and the entrance ramp also closed. Further up, Braddock Road inner loop, the accident there blocking two right lanes. Going into Maryland, southbound along the Baltimore-Washington Parkway, very heavy traffic as you make your way toward the Anne Arundel-Prince George's County line. And in Montgomery County, U.S. Route 29, the northbound lane shut down at Lockwood Drive. Now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Storm Watch 7 forecast.
Showers through lunchtime, but after that, rain goes away, clouds will be on the decrease, and a little bit of sunshine to end your Saturday. Temperatures into the low 60s. Tonight we fall down to 49. Tomorrow it's 68 for a high temperature and plenty of sunshine. I'm 7 News meteorologist Jordan Evans in the First Alert Weather Center.
44 degrees in Washington. I'm Heather Curtis on WMAL.
Your favorite WMAL shows when you want them. Download the new WMAL app and listen on demand.
7:38, it is the Saturday Morning Update. I'm Rick Fowler. We are joined by Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer. He is the author of Operation Dark Heart and the president of the London Center for Policy Research. Tony, good morning.
Hey, good morning, Rick. Always great to join you.
Drone attack Thursday left one American contractor dead, another one wounded, along with five U.S. troops. Washington says the attack was of Iranian origin. U.S. carrying out strikes in eastern Syria in response. And first off, Tony, what is the mission of the U.S. in Syria? Why are we there?
Well, it's really unclear at this point because this is something that President Trump actually said we needed to end, but obviously it wasn't ended. And I know Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Joe Dunford, was attempting to prevent the expansion of the mission because once they had the U.S. forces had essentially done their job and limited ISIS from that region, Central Command started looking for other things to do. So at this point, as far as I can tell, it's a U.S. mission looking for a purpose. And these folks hanging out there are simply, I guess I understand it, trying to, quote unquote, peacekeep and keep the area from falling back into ISIS hands. And I'm being very generous in my assessment of the situation.
President Biden said yesterday that he warned Iran that the United States would act forcefully to protect U.S. troops. However, right, there was Pentagon testimony on Thursday that there have been 78 attacks on U.S. forces since 2021. You mentioned peacekeeping. That's not very peaceful.
Yeah, well, that's the issue. It's like, what are we doing there? Again, we're not a natural combatant in that region. We've had issues, obviously, when we had to come in and deal with ISIS. But beyond that, there are players who are there on the ground permanently, such as the Iranians, IRGC, the Syrian forces. And it's, again, unclear on what exactly we're trying to accomplish other than being targets, which I would argue we are always targets. Once we deploy forces, we are always a target, and we will see 78 attacks if we're just hanging out in the desert somewhere. So it's not a surprise. What is a surprise, though, is the fact that these drones were able to get in so close to positions which have been there since, by all accounts, since about 2020, or maybe even before. So the fact is, even if we're there, I don't think they're doing an adequate job of being postured to defend the forces on the ground, which is, again, something that has to be looked at. And the other thing, Rick, to remember, we're in close proximity to the Russians. The Russians are also there. This has been a point of conflict in Britain for a while, where there's actually been incidents where the U.S. has accidentally killed Russian contractors. So this is not a good place. It's not a settled place. And, again, you're hanging out with dangerous people who have drones who don't like you. Bad things are going to happen.
Okay, so this is attributed to Iran's Revolutionary
right.
Guard Corps.
IRGC, right.
Now, the Pentagon spokesman said that the radar was tracking the drone, but there are reports that the air defense system was not working. What do we know about that?
That's what I'm saying. So apparently, from the accounts I've read, the system was not adequately prepared to actually do its job. So I don't know if it's complacency. I don't know if they don't understand or have not been able to track the updates and upgrades to the Iranian drones, but clearly it failed. And again, this goes back to the fact of, you know, we have to examine why we're there, what we're doing. Have we adequately armed the troops who are going to be asked to be there to the mission they're trying to do? So this is something I think the American public needs to examine. There needs to be debates on this. We're already doing all these other things globally. And as much as anything, it's great to be able to provide military support to stop a terrorist organization. But once that terrorist organization is defeated and you're just hanging out, again, I'm not sure the practicality of just hanging out in the desert waiting for something bad to happen. So I think that's the way I'm looking at this right now.
In the Reuters report, it says the retaliatory strikes by the U.S. on what it said were facilities in Syria used by groups affiliated to the IRGC. Tell us a little bit about the IRGC and those affiliate groups.
So I'm not against striking the IRGC. As a matter of fact, for those who have read Darkheart, we were running operations in 2003, Rick, that actually were being funded by Soleimani and the Iranians to actually help get the resistance, the attacks against us in Afghanistan in 2003. Plus, the Iranians, the IRGC, were providing penetrating IEDs to the rebels in Iraq during the Iraq War. So the Iranians have been behind a lot of bad things. So this is not new. The IRGC is that element of the Iranian Quds Force, which actually is essentially a form of Wagner, I guess, to use a loose analogy, Wagner being that organization that Putin uses to go do his bad things. The IRGC is that which the Iranian government uses to go do bad things against others overseas. And again, Soleimani was one of the leaders that President Trump had killed, who was one of the leaders who did this sort of thing. So what we're talking about here is nothing new. This is a terrorist organization. Iran is one of the largest sponsors of global terror. The IRGC is that action wing, which actually does those operations for it.
I have some audio from General Milley about Iran's nuclear capabilities here.
Iran could produce fissile material for a nuclear weapon in less than 2 weeks, and would only take several more months to produce an actual nuclear weapon. But the United States remains committed, as a matter of policy, that Iran will not have a fielded nuclear weapon.
So when you hear that, what do you as a national security expert feel about it, and what do we do next on this?
So, Milley, I know Mark, and it's like, okay, Mark, putting together uranium and having it ready to go in a bomb in a few months is not real. That's something out of a script of an episode of 24, maybe. This is not real. Look, the Iranians probably already have at least two or three usable nuclear weapons that they obtained from North Korea. They're not going to use them, Rick, because they would suffer enormous consequences regarding retaliation. What they're trying to do is establish a path to have multiple warheads produced over a period of time. That's what they're trying to do. And so this constant, drum beating from both sides have done this, both left and right, about a nuclear weapons. Look, they've got a nuclear weapon. Let's accept that. The question becomes, how do we prevent them from making an industrial investment and being able to produce these things at a broad level, producing 10, 20, 30 of these things? So that's the issue at this point. And at this point, the Iranians are quietly and incrementally walking up to the industrial scale production of nuclear weapons. That's what's going on. And so when Milley says stuff like that, it's not helpful. When others beat their chest and say, we need to go do something, it's like, yeah, we do. But Rick, what they're saying regarding fieldable nuclear weapons is not relevant to what the Iranians are trying to do long term. And so we have to focus on the long term. Do we want them to be able to produce nuclear weapons at an industrial scale? That's the issue, and nobody seems to be talking about that.
Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer, catch the Thought to Action podcast at londoncenter.org. Tony, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks, Rick.
7:46, Saturday morning update. KT McFarland next, but first, Mike Franciotti's in the WMAL Traffic Center.
In Montgomery County, the accident along Columbia Pike at Lockwood Drive had finally cleared. All the northbound lanes open. Southbound left lane looks like it still might be blocked at Lockwood Drive. No issues on the Beltway at this time in Maryland. Southbound along the BW Parkway, traffic is jammed up as you make your way down toward the Anne Arundel, Prince George's County line. Going into Virginia, the interloop at Van Dorn, that accident finally cleared. Further up at Braddock Road, have an accident there blocking three right lanes. Now from GarageStoreRepair.com, the WMAL Storm Watch 7 forecast.
Showers stick around through lunchtime, but after that, rain goes away, clouds will be on the decrease, and a little bit of sunshine to end your Saturday. Temperatures into the low 60s right around 6 p.m. Tonight we fall down to 49. Tomorrow it's 68 for a high temperature. Northwest winds around 15 to 20 miles per hour and plenty of sunshine. I'm 7 News meteorologist Jordan Evans from the First Alert Weather Center.
43 degrees in the nation's capital, 747 Saturday morning update.
That's code FULL.
7:50 Saturday morning update continues. I'm Rick Fowler. KT McFarland joins us. She was President Trump's Deputy National Security Advisor. She is a board member of the American Conservative Union and the author of the bestseller, Revolution, Trump, Washington, and We the People. KT, good morning.
Good morning.
We've seen the outcome of the meetings with Vladimir Putin and Xi Jinping, echoes of the Cold War. Well, we did win the Cold War under the leadership of President Reagan. You were working in the White House at the time. You were actually in the Oval Office when President Reagan delivered the Star Wars speech. What can we learn from the Reagan administration looking forward, as we'll have to deal with Putin and Xi Jinping?
You know, I've been doing a lot of thinking about the Reagan years and why they were such a revolutionary change, not only in American society and the economy, but really in our foreign policy. And it's the 40th anniversary of almost every major thing that Reagan did. So 40 years ago in early March, he gave a speech to the evangelicals, and he said he painted communism versus democracy as like a moral struggle between darkness and light. At the time, and it's hard to believe today, but at the time, people were really flirting with communism. Oh, the Soviet Union had a superior, the economy was superior, they had military buildup, their military was superior. We were in a superpower race that we were losing. And on college campuses and in the intelligence, much like today, they were flirting with communism and how great the Soviet Union was. And at a minimum, the United States and the Soviet Union were considered morally equivalent. But it wasn't good versus evil. It was just two superpowers duking it out on the world stage, like superpowers have always done since the beginning of time. Reagan said, no, no, this is really different. This is, we democracy, represent the sovereignty of the individual to make his choice to choose his leaders. Communism represents the sovereignty of the state, that some small handful of people are going to dictate to everybody else what they should believe in, how they should live, how they should worship, how they should work. And Reagan said, that's the battle between good and evil. And then 3 weeks later, 2 weeks later, really, he gave the Star Wars speech. It's called the Star Wars speech, although it started as a speech about the Reagan defense budget, the Reagan defense buildup, and the need for deterrence. And I wrote the first draft of that speech. I was the Pentagon speechwriter, and I'm very proud to say that some of my best lines were kept in the final version that President Reagan did. But the importance of the speech was Reagan said, I'm going to use that speech, and I'm going to do something really revolutionary. I'm going to propose that the United States build a missile defense shield to protect us against nuclear annihilation. And it was, we didn't have that kind of weapon. We didn't even have the technologies to build that kind of weapon. We had sort of glimmerings of things that we might be able to do 20 years down the road. But what President Reagan did was he said, I'm going to throw out this speech, and I'm going to challenge the American scientific community to make a missile defense shield. And so it was a very small group of people who were in on what Reagan was going to do. Normally a presidential speech has layers upon layers in the bureaucracy and the agencies and the White House who all get involved and sort of vet it. In this case, no. The speech they were all vetting was mine. The speech that made a big difference was what Reagan inserted a couple of paragraphs into the middle of the speech, which he only had a handful of people who knew about on the National Security Advisor's office and the science office, his speechwriter's office, and I was from the Pentagon. There was somebody else from State. Anyway, Reagan gives this speech, and he says he challenges the American scientific community to build a missile defense shield that then we would share, that we would have shields against these evil nuclear weapons because we couldn't seem to get rid of them. And at the time, everybody thought, oh, well, Reagan doesn't know what he's talking about. But in the end, as you look back over 40 years, that was what made the difference. That particular proposal was probably what tipped the balance in the Cold War. The value of Reagan today is the same value that he had when he was president. everybody kind of dismissed him as just so wasn't very smart, just, you know, a Hollywood actor, nice guy, but really didn't have the chops to be president. But it turned out that he challenged conventional wisdom at every score, and particularly in the Cold War. At the time, thinking was, well, the United States and the Soviet Union armed to the teeth with nuclear weapons, we have only two choices. We live in a Cold War where we're going to have constant arms race, we're constant proxy wars, because the alternative to a Cold War is a hot war, which is nuclear war, which nobody wins, the world dies, you know, World War III and the world's over. Reagan said, no, no, there's a third way, and the third way is to use America's superior economy and our technology and to use that to, frankly, bankrupt the Soviet Union, to show the Soviet Union what a system of failure that it ultimately would be, but to bankrupt the Soviet Union to the point where then we would win the Cold War. And it just seemed so far-fetched at the time, but within 10 years, the Soviet Union collapsed. I think that's what we've got to start figuring out today. How do we break through the conventional wisdom? You know, if you look at the people running American foreign policy, the neocons or the Wilsonians and the Democrat Party, the war hawks, they all seem to be thinking in the same old ruts. Well, we're going to defeat the Soviet Union, now Russia. We're going to defeat them on the battlefield of Ukraine. Russia's going to collapse. Some pro-Western leader is going to emerge in Putin's wake. Everything's going to be fine. With regard to China, well, they're not quite sure how to deal with China, but there's a growing sense that something's very wrong with the U.S.-China relationship and a growing recognition that China wants to dominate the world, not as a superpower, but as the sole superpower. So I think we need to be thinking outside the box, like Reagan did. And who can help us find a way to deal with, I think, a war that can be quite easily dealt with Russia, the proxy war, which is once we start restarting the American energy industry, prices of oil and gas go down, Putin's bankrupt, he can't fight the war. But the more important one, which is China, how do we deal with China? And I think there's some good ideas perking up, but nobody's got the complete answer.
K.T. McFarland, author of Revolution, Trump, Washington, and We the People. K.T., fascinating, and it's always an honor to have you with us. Thank you.
Thank you. Honor and pleasure for me.
And that's it for the Saturday morning update. Thank you very much for being with us. Garden Sense, coming up this afternoon at 1.